This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. On the day the United Nations won the Nobel Peace Prize, and the day after President Bush suggested that the UN rebuild Afghanistan, tough questions emerge. Why is the UN on the sidelines in this international conflict? Where is its voice? What is its role? This hour, we'll be taking a hard look at the United Nations in this time of crisis. But first, assessing the first week of attacks in Afghanistan. Is the United States military on target with its goals? For answers, we turn to retired Brigadier General John Ruppert. Good evening, General Ruppert.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
What's your assessment of the first week of U.S. military strikes in Afghanistan? Is it mission accomplished?
I think it's been extraordinarily successful. They have suppressed all air defense systems. They have targeted key command and control and communications facilities, and have destroyed some of the Taliban bases.
Any surprises in the way they've carried out the mission so far?
No, there are no real surprises. We knew that there were a few targets in that environment for air power, the instrument that we've used so far, but we have used it effectively and have not met any resistance.
From the American public perspective, there hasn't been a lot of information released. We've seen some photographs. Is there any reason to doubt that the attacks on facilities have been fully successful?
There is none.
Mm-hmm. And are we going about this campaign at full force, hammer and tongs? There's been talk that we've been avoiding going after Kabul or making Kabul more vulnerable to keep it from falling into the hands of the Northern Alliance prematurely. Do you buy that theory?
No, I don't think that's correct. I think the reason we haven't attacked more forcefully the major population centers such as Kabul is, as the president made very clear, it is not a war against the people. It is against the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda organization that are hosted in Afghanistan.
What about U.S. forces in Pakistan? The reports that they're on the ground there now, do you anticipate that they'll be participating in the conflict from Pakistan, or is there a different mission?
Well, it's unclear. I mean, clearly the Pakistanis have been very helpful to us. You would want to have intelligence people working with their intelligence people. It is the closest facility to where the combat is likely to take place. You would want to have a large support infrastructure in place. And so it is not clear that those are the fighters, per se.
There's also been talk about Turkey lending soldiers to the multinational force. What role might Turkish soldiers play?
In a military sense, it is unclear because it's unlikely to be the kind of conventional force that Turkey has in such large numbers. On the psychological front, if you can imagine bin Laden saying this is a war of Muslims against infidels and fighting on the side of the United States, you had the Pakistanis, the Northern Alliance, and the Turks, all Muslim populations, it would certainly raise questions about the validity of his call to a holy war.
General, there's been a lot of attention paid to damage to Taliban facilities, but what do we know about damage inflicted to troops and weaponry, tanks and so on?
Well, we would be unlikely to get any specific information on individual soldiers or troops that were killed, and the kinds of strikes are very limited in number that we have been carrying out. I think that we can be fairly confident from the initial reporting that some of their heaviest equipment, their air defense equipment, their armor, and their aircraft have all been attacked, and substantial damage has been done to them.
In the last decade, we've seen different kinds of military missions around the world, some led by NATO or UN commands, and this, despite the coalition veneer being primarily a U.S. military exercise, which seems to be more effective in your mind?
Well, each of the militaries involved, whether it is in Kosovo or in Bosnia or in the Gulf War, has particular strengths that we try to draw on in forming an alliance. Obviously, when you're relying on technology, as we are now, it is the United States which always has the leading role. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you're talking about on-the-ground intelligence, there we are the recipient of support from other states that have far better resources and information to help us. Depending on how the conflict evolves, we may call more on states that have the particular strengths that we lack.
And finally, General, we heard before the shooting began that there were precious few worthy targets in Afghanistan. After a week that's been a fairly intense bombardment, do you think we've just about run out of targets?
Well, we've run out of what the Air Force tends to call high-value targets: fixed command and control communications, established bunker systems, airfields, those types of things. So we will probably change the nature of the air campaign. The air campaign may be done in support of future ground operations at this time, and they will continue their own campaign to make sure that al-Qaeda and bin Laden have no place to rest. We've seen the start of that over the last 2 days as they've come in with the large bombs designed to penetrate into the earth and destroy bunkers and underground facilities in the type of place that bin Laden might be hiding.
General Ruppert, thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much.
John Ruppert is a retired brigadier general in the U.S. Army. He's executive director for research at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. We're talking about the United Nations on the sidelines this hour. Since it was established in 1945, preserving world peace has been one of its main goals. But what about the present world conflict? Is the United Nations now just a cleanup crew for U.S. and British troops? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now is David Malone. David Malone is former ambassador to the United Nations from Canada and is president of the International Peace Academy in New York. Thank you very much for joining us this evening, Ambassador Malone.
Thank you.
Also with us is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beattie, joining us tonight from New Hampshire Public Radio. Hello, Jack.
Hi, John.
Ambassador Malone, if I may come to you first, here we have a grand day for the UN in one sense. It's receiving the Nobel Peace Prize for the organization and for the General Secretary, Secretary General Kofi Annan. At the same time, the big action seems not to be in the UN's hands today, as U.S. forces and some British forces are have been all week pounding Afghanistan. What are we to make of this? It looks like the UN is sidelined here. Does it look that way to you?
Not really. The UN is not active militarily. The military action is certainly in American and British hands, as you say. But the UN has been extremely active politically since the attacks on the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. The day after these attacks, the Security Council of the UN adopted the most sweeping resolution of its history, supporting the U.S. right to self-defense and terming the attacks as a threat to international peace and security. 6 days later, in support of the United States, the Security Council adopted an extremely sweeping resolution again on requiring governments all around the world to track and stop terrorists, to choke off their financial supplies, and set up a committee to monitor compliance with this. These are extraordinarily sweeping measures at the international level. So I don't think the UN is sidelined in that way at all. On the military front, it has to be recognized the UN has no capabilities of its own. It's always reliant on member states for military capabilities in any event.
But is this the kind of military action that the UN founders in 1945 foresaw as the UN came into its own?
Absolutely. There's an article in the UN Charter, which is the UN's constitution, that explicitly lines out the right to self-defense, either individually or collectively, in the case of attack. And this is a clear case of an attack on a member state of the UN, unprovoked. And the right to self-defense was not only recognized in the Charter, but explicitly sanctioned by the Security Council the following day. I don't know how the Council's role could have been played out any more clearly.
But there's dispute over that. I've seen in the Toronto Globe and Mail from your fellow Canadian Michael Mandel, professor of law at Osgoode Hall Law School in Toronto, has written that Article 51 does not extend the right of unilateral self-defense to retaliate once an attack has stopped. And he says that the U.S. action in Afghanistan now is illegal by the United Nations' own charter.
Do you really think the terrorist campaign against the U.S. has stopped?
Well, that's
in that sense, I would disagree.
We're told it hasn't.
Professor Mandel, and furthermore, even if what he said was true, beyond Article 51 in the Charter, there has been the Security Council decision of September 12th. The U.S. right to self-defense in this instance, and I say it as a Canadian, could not be much more clear under international law.
Jack Beattie, given the world's anticipation of a growing role for the United Nations that grew in the late 80s and 90s as peacekeeping came to the fore, do you see the UN's current role in this crisis as compatible with what expectations were building or falling during that time?
Well, it's been an up-and-down story for the UN in America. The idea of a concert of nations to keep the peace comes out of the Enlightenment and pamphlet of Immanuel Kant's called Perpetual Peace, and that was cited by Woodrow Wilson in World War I when he proposed as one of his 14 points, one of the bases, one of the goals of World War I, to create a concert of nations to keep the peace and to deter possible predators against it. And, of course, when the Senate turned that down, it broke the heart of the world, he said. Franklin Roosevelt revived it at the Dumbarton Oaks Conference in 1944, and Mrs. Roosevelt herself played a crucial role in its human rights convention. And through the Cold War, it was sort of stymied because of the veto in the Security Council, and the American right began to reject what really had been a kind of American idea. You saw in the 60s signs that said, get the U.S. out of the U.N. and so on. And then in the 70s, the U.N. became, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan put it in a famous book, a dangerous place, a place where third world nations, primarily in the General Assembly, voted against American and especially Israeli interests, especially with the Zionism is racism picture. And in the and of course, since then, the United States has been actually withholding funds from the UN until very recently. So this American political culture, although this idea was sort of aborned here, it has the lineage in Wilson and Roosevelt and so on, it has received a great deal of distrust from the American public. And in a sense, I think that has weakened the UN in American eyes. What do you think about that, Ambassador? You've seen it from afar.
Ambassador Malone?
I'm afraid I can't hear Professor Mr. Beattie's answer, so I'm at somewhat of a disadvantage.
Oh, let me pass it on to you. Jack Beattie was just saying that over time, the U.S. has very early on embraced the ideals of the U.N., but there's been a lot of disillusionment and a political move away from the U.N. in some U.S. quarters. How do you see the current relationship between the United States and the United Nations?
Well, I think Mr. Beattie's right. The U.S. was key in founding the U.N. and invested many hopes in it. And at the time of the Korean crisis and in the 50s, the U.N. seemed to be an instrument the U.S. was very comfortable using. The U.N. Was extremely useful to the U.S. again at the time of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. It provided the forum in which a massive coalition was built by Washington to expel Iraq from Kuwait, which was successfully done. But during the 1990s, particularly after the death of Army Rangers in Somalia, the U.S. seemed to drift away and seemed to forget the usefulness of partners and allies in many international ventures. And unfortunately, we saw a reflection of this in the early months of the Bush administration. However, at this point, I think we're seeing a U-turn in Washington and renewed emphasis on the value of allies and partnerships, and the president now wanting the UN to take on the role of reconstructing Afghanistan, a role the U.S. certainly doesn't want to play on its own.
Jack, in the few seconds we have before the break, do you agree with the ambassador's assessment that the U.S. is truly embracing a more multilateral coalition approach now?
Well, that seems to have been the case all through. I mean, with the Europeans, with the Arab states that we're trying to get on our side, and now looking to the UN to try to do something in fractured Afghanistan. So yes, that has been a turn in the entire rhetoric and face of the Bush administration post September 11th.
And yet, there has been that underlying message from George Bush that it's my way or the highway, that the U.S. is going to is drawing a line here between good and evil, and get on board with us, or you are our enemy. Listeners, what do you think? Is the UN playing the appropriate role in the current crisis, or is it too far in the back seat? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. An updated list of entities whose assets have been frozen by our government is listed on our website. To check it out, log on to WBOR.org and click on Special Coverage. We'll be back after a brief break with more conversation on the UN in the midst of crisis. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. The Nobel Peace Prize is awarded to those who have bestowed the greatest benefit to mankind. Throughout its history, the prize has been granted to recipients from a wide range of countries reflecting a spectrum of political and social views. Past winners include Mother Teresa, Henry Kissinger, Nelson Mandela, and Albert Schweitzer. Dr. Martin Luther King accepted the prize in 1964. His words then still resonate today in light of the present world crisis.
I still believe that one day mankind will bow before the altars of God and be crowned triumphant over war and bloodshed, and nonviolent redemptive goodwill proclaim the rule of the land, and none shall be afraid.
That was Dr. Martin Luther King accepting his Nobel Peace Prize in 1964. Earlier today, Kofi Annan, Secretary General of the United Nations, recalled his reaction to a phone call early this morning from the Nobel Foundation.
Given, as I said, the sort of business we are in, usually when you get a call that early in the morning, it's something disastrous. And I also see it as a great encouragement for me personally and also for the organization. And in a way, Nobel has reaffirmed the indispensable role this organization should play in international affairs.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan earlier today talking about the indispensable role of the UN in world affairs. We're looking at that role this hour. Do you think that the United Nations is playing a sufficiently active role in the crisis and in response to that crisis unfolding all around the world today, including in Afghanistan? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Are you more comfortable with an activist UN or without it? We're joined this evening by Ambassador David Malone, former Canadian ambassador to the United Nations and president of the International Peace Academy, an independent international think tank in New York, and by our special coverage news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly, Jack Beatty. Ambassador Malone, last night, in the midst of his press conference, President Bush very explicitly referred to the UN as the institution that might lead the rebuilding, or as he sort of reluctantly put it, nation-building process in Afghanistan after this current conflict ends, however it ends. Does that seem to you to be an appropriate role for the United Nations?
Well, I'm afraid it's an inevitable role for the United Nations. There is no regional organization like the European Union or the Organization of American States to which Afghanistan belongs. And that, in the absence of such an organization, it falls to the UN to lead on reconstructing Afghanistan. However, I don't think the UN will take over the government of Afghanistan. It's a fractured and fractious country, and I think Afghans need to lead it. But they will need a great deal of assistance in terms of advice. They'll need a great deal of economic aid as well. And I think the UN is relatively well-placed to provide that. I say relatively well-placed because Afghanistan is one of the most difficult countries, if not the most difficult country of the world, to try to help.
Jack Beatty, it looks like in some ways a convenient out for President Bush. He's always been dismissive of nation building. He attacked the Democrats for it in his presidential campaign. And now when the bombing's done, he's talking about handing it over to the UN.
Yeah, his father, 2 days after the bombing, in a speech here in Boston, which many took as a kind of semaphore to his son, that the world had changed, he said this was Pearl Harbor. And he said just as Pearl Harbor threw on the scrap heap a whole bunch of assumptions that were current in the world of the 1930s about isolationism and unilateralism and so on, so September 11th should have a similar effect. And I think that I think his son has got that message, that, yes, this much despised institution, certainly by members of his party. After all, it was Senator Helms who for years almost single-handedly prevented the United States from paying its dues to the United Nations. But Bush has come around to see the unique role that this institution can play, not only in actually doing things, but in lending a kind of legitimacy. I'm struck again and again as I read comments from the Islamic world how much legitimacy the UN seems to have among third world nations. I wonder what the ambassador has to say about that.
Ambassador Malone?
Well, I think the UN is perceived as an organization where poor countries, developing countries, have a voice. By and large, they feel they have no voice when they're dealing with rich and powerful countries, including the United States. I think in this particular context, the United Nations has some credibility because in the disputes in the Middle East in the past, UN peacekeeping has, by and large, been successful and has been seen by the Arab side, at least, as relatively neutral and impartial. So to that extent, I do think the UN is well equipped in the Islamic part of the world to play some role. But I suspect peacekeeping as such in Afghanistan is a bridge too far and shouldn't be attempted.
What's the distinction between nation building and peacekeeping here? How will we ever pull those apart? We don't expect it to turn into a Garden of Eden any day soon.
Oh, it definitely won't turn into a Garden of Eden anytime soon. The difference really is that peacekeeping is largely an instrument to calm passions. It's carried out by military personnel on the ground. It's meant to encourage a process of cooling down while political differences are mediated. I think in the case of Afghanistan, frankly, political differences are going to have to be mediated before the UN does very much. We're going to have a new government in Afghanistan, and I think the UN special envoy for Afghanistan, a highly respected Algerian man called Lakhdar Brahimi, is the best placed individual internationally to try to pull the Afghan tribal leaderships together, possibly around the deposed king of Afghanistan, to agree on some new form of government. Again, there the UN can be very useful. It's not something the U.S. should probably be trying to impose on Afghanistan.
But when you say that the political differences will have to be mediated first, are you talking in part about the very bombardment that's going on right now? That's a kind of mediation by beating down the party in power.
Well, you know, I think the Taliban are going to be out of the picture fairly soon. I may be proved wrong, but my impression is that the Taliban power base is probably imploding right now. So we won't be dealing with them for very long, but we will be dealing for some time with Pakistan and its concerns. It will be able to front a number of local parties. And so pulling together as many legitimate leaders representing real interests in Afghanistan as possible to try to agree on some future government will be a very worthwhile activity, and one that probably the United States, France, Britain, these countries should steer clear of.
We're talking about the United Nations and its appropriate role in the crisis facing the world right now and in Afghanistan now and in a post-conflict era. What's your view? Is it a cop-out for the U.S. to hand off the nation building to the United Nations when the shooting is done in Afghanistan, or is that the right role for the United Nations? Are you happy to see them come in when the smoke clears? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Dorian is on the line. Welcome, Dorian. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm calling to ask to find out why Bush didn't go to the United Nations immediately after the terrorist attack, and why did it take a month for him to realize that if we want to get anything accomplished, it would be better for our position if we had the support of other nations in the world.
Well, Dorian, thanks for your call. I think the U.S. was in contact with the UN early on, but I guess this week was President Bush's first big public recognition of a role for the UN in this crisis. Ambassador Malone, can you walk us through the steps that have taken place since the September 11th attacks in terms of U.S.-UN relations?
Yes. I think the first thing that happened was the U.S. wanted to codify formally the type of support it was getting internationally, which was pretty well universal. The only country I'm aware of that didn't support the U.S. in the wake of the attacks was Iraq. And so on the 12th of September, there was a very sweeping Security Council resolution of support in affirming the U.S.'s right to self-defense. On the 18th of September, at the request of the United States, the UN adopted, the Security Council adopted a resolution seeking to block the movements of terrorists, track them down, have them detained, and choke off their financing. Now, those were early steps. I think the Bush administration wasn't yet focused on much beyond internal security, which is understandable, and immediate military responses to the attacks on New York and Washington. Now, I think the administration is looking beyond what happens militarily in Afghanistan and recognizes that there's a responsibility to help this wrecked country, where the military campaign will have created further difficulties in feeding and heating a population terribly vulnerable and very much at risk this winter. The Bush administration and the allies more generally don't want to be left holding the bag on mass starvation or deaths from exposure in Afghanistan this winter. And I think commendably, the president and his advisors are looking ahead and trying to see what can be done to forestall that.
And yet the UN's Mary Robinson has been warning that, in fact, that starvation is very close at hand, and some of it may already be inevitable.
It is close at hand, and I fear a number of people will die of starvation and exposure this winter. But what the administration, it seems to me, is trying to do is casting about with allies for means of minimizing that.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're asking, what is the appropriate role of the United Nations in the new crisis that we're facing in the war on terrorism? Join the conversation. Liz is on the line. Welcome, Liz. You're on the air. Oh, I'm sorry. I think we lost Liz. Ambassador David Malone, here's a question. Early on in this conflict, we heard a number of Middle Eastern nations saying that they would support military action against the perpetrators of the terrorism, but they wanted it to be UN-led. That never seemed to be seriously considered by Washington. Why not?
Well, I think militarily, Washington wants to keep its hands untied. And I have quite a lot of sympathy for that. The UN has not done well at forcible military activity over time. That is much better carried out by individual governments or groups of governments working together. There is very broad UN cover for this military operation. I'd say the concern at the international level, and very much in the Muslim world, is that large numbers of civilians, Afghan civilians, not be killed as a result of this military action. You know, none of the individuals who attacked in the United States, as far as we know, are Afghans. Osama bin Laden isn't an Afghan. He took advantage of the civil war in Afghanistan to infiltrate himself and his group. He paid off the Taliban to provide him with hospitality. The Afghans, in many ways, are brutalized and rather innocent bystanders in this business. And there are tremendous worries that large numbers of civilians will die. That's not the case so far. The attacks have been targeted, but perhaps not coincidentally, the first four confirmed casualties were UN employees involved in demining in Afghanistan.
Jack Beatty, are you confident that it's going to be a clean enough end to this conflict, that the United States will indeed be able to hand it off to the United Nations? I saw in the New York Times today, Robert Orr, a National Security Council official in the Clinton White House, called the situation Somalia Plus for President Bush. And he said they know they don't have the capability to get they need to get American troops out of there and hand it off to other countries and international organizations that can help stabilize the country and address its profound needs. It's a pretty hairy region and situation. Is it going to be that simple that President Bush can hand it off to the UN when the shooting stops?
I can't imagine that it's going to be that simple. That the U.S. will obviously have to police, I think, for a good while, the security situation there, and it may involve keeping these which is here, I guess, where Somalia scenarios come in, keeping and maybe even Balkan ones, keeping some of these ethnic groups, these tribes, from one another's throats, keeping these political movements from destroying one another. And there's such a delicate quality to this. to this intervention because it has always in the background the primacy of Pakistan. And just this week, General Musharraf in Pakistan said that he had received, quote, definite assurances that this was going to be a short bombing campaign and indeed a short intervention. And President Bush said, I don't know who told the president of Pakistan that. Mm. Now, this is a very the idea that we're going to stay there for a long time has all the complications within Afghanistan, but an even larger complication without it in the fragility of Pakistan and in its historic decision to side with us here. And already we see rifts developing between even what we have told the Pakistanis or what they understood us to be doing and what we say we're going to be doing.
Which could create a pretty dicey environment for UN in a rebuilding phase. We're talking about the proper role of the United Nations in the crisis we're facing now in the war on terrorism. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Has the UN been prominent enough in this crisis for your liking? Sarah is on the line. Welcome, Sarah. Good to have you.
Good evening. I wanted to look at the role of the UN in a stronger role. I grew up in a family where I had a grandmother who was American and worked in China, a mother who was American but happened to be born in Beirut in Lebanon, and I have always, all my life, taken an attitude of that I learned from my grandma, which we called the Declaration of Interdependence, where we viewed countries as being more interdependent. And I've always striven to achieve a world where there was more. It was more like a United Nations vision, in the same way that we have a United States here, where each nation would function much like the states in the U.S.
So is the world lining up with that vision in your mind right now?
Well, what worries me is that I think that when we have nations that immediately start flag waving as soon as there is a rupture of the peace, it seems to me that we don't move ahead with that vision, and that in the long run all of us suffer. And what I've been wondering was whether there was a role for giving the UN more teeth militarily, just as our federal government has a military and a policing function.
We need that on an
international level, and I think that could be extended to help the situation between the Palestinians and the Israelis also, because what's going on is we're having you can say that the two are unrelated, but in the minds of the Arab world, there's no excuse for what happened in New York and the terrorism that was perpetrated in Washington also. But on the other hand, those two are linked from the point of view of a large portion of the world. And I think that one has to acknowledge that. And when one confronts the Afghan issue, I think the long-run peace issue, if we want to prevent further terrorism on us, it may not come next time from Afghanistan. It may come from some other faction. And I think that it's very important for us to listen. And it seems to me the UN is the only entity that can really take an independent role and work on this. What's happened is for years, the Palestinians...
Sarah, you've raised a lot of good points. We're going to have to come back to them after the break. Sarah, thanks very much. You've raised many good points. We'll come to them right after the break. We're talking about the United Nations, its role in the current crisis. Sarah asks, should the UN have more teeth, not less, and should it be more engaged on the ground in policing peace than it has been so far? We'll come back to that. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or join the conversations online at WBOR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this evening about the United Nations and its role in the current crisis. Is it sufficient? Is it the right role for the UN? Just before the break, we had a call from Sarah asking about, well, she had several great points, and I want to bring you in on this, Ambassador David Malone. And the first was an atmospheric point, that she grew up in an internationalist family, looking forward to a more internationalist era, and somehow, despite the UN winning the Nobel Peace Prize today, the UN era doesn't seem to sit easily with the super patriotic, flag-waving moment that we're in now, and perhaps also not with this image of an outraged superpower calling the tune. Is this moment that we're in, does it reflect the spirit of what the UN founders hoped for by the time we got to the year 2001, do you believe?
Well, the UN founders lived in a very different world in 1945. They did foresee military force being entrusted to the UN Security Council. But since then, no government has been willing to lend its troops under the complete control of the Council, and it just hasn't happened. Secondly, when the UN has been authorized to use force with troops that it did have at its disposal, it hasn't made a good job of it. And I think the reason is that the UN operates in a culture of consensus, peace, mediation. It won the Nobel Peace Prize. It didn't win the Nobel War Prize.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so this notion of putting teeth in the UN's pocket, giving them more armed force, is an antiquated one now? Do you think that's just on the dustbin of history?
I don't think it's quite on the dustbin of history. It's been unachievable so far. I don't think it's achievable in the short term at all. It's important to remember that the Security Council is very much in the picture, is monitoring current action, that the U.S., in order to maintain the international support, the very impressive international support it has, is going to have to tread very warily. The U.S. doesn't have a blank check to attack any government, any country around the world where there may be terrorists. It's simply impractical to take on too much at any given time, and support will be eroded internationally if the U.S. broadens its military aims very much beyond Afghanistan, in my view. In fact, Prime Minister Blair of Britain signaled yesterday very clearly that the British are in this military operation for Afghanistan only.
And yet, Jack Beatty, while the U.S. has worked on building a coalition, Colin Powell has been working the telephones assiduously. Doesn't it still feel like the U.N., the U.S. delivering the sort of my way or the highway? It doesn't really feel like the U.N. guiding this in any institutional way, does it?
No, it doesn't. But we've been attacked. There's been a state of war.
Mm-hmm.
Any nation has the right to defend itself. And I don't know that we're behaving differently from what any other nation would do. To go back to a point that Sarah raised, because I think it's important, we've talked about how the United States has failed in its obligations to the United Nations. But then, as the ambassador said, the United Nations has not written a very glorious chapter in policing the peace in the 1990s, mm-hmm. and notably in the Balkans, where Dutch peacekeepers in Srebrenica basically stood by while there was a massacre of 5,000 or 6,000, 8,000 men and boys. The French connived with the Serbs in various ways. It was a very, very ugly picture. And it's hard to work up any great confidence in the UN as a warfighting, but even as a policing entity after looking at the record in the Balkans.
So decade by decade, ideals give way to the reality of how conflicts unfold. Ambassador David Malone, I want to thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation.
David Malone is former Canadian ambassador to the United Nations and president of the International Peace Academy, an independent international think tank in New York. If you would like, you may continue this conversation on the UN and its role. Continue it at our website, that is. You click on WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. It's been an extraordinary month, a time few will ever forget. Our special coverage producers have pulled together a montage of sound reflecting the experience we've all shared. We start on a beautiful September morning in a classroom in Sarasota, Florida, with President Bush. It was September 11th.
I do want to thank the folks here at Booker Elementary School for their hospitality. Today we've had a national tragedy. Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center in an apparent terrorist attack on our country.
Let's look at the north. Quickly.
Coming down.
Oh my God.
The second tower.
Oh.
I really have to commend them. If you really want to know what New Yorkers were all about, you just watch the way in which they handled themselves. They didn't panic. They moved deliberately. They moved swiftly. But they didn't hurt each other. They helped each other. I mean, these are just the most wonderful people in the world.
The Taliban must act and act immediately. They will hand over the terrorists or they will share in their fate. I also want to speak tonight directly to Muslims throughout the world. We respect your faith. It's practiced freely by many millions of Americans and by millions more in countries that America counts as friends. Its teachings are good and peaceful. And those who commit evil in the name of Allah blaspheme the name of Allah. The terrorists...
But if we follow the principles that have served us here so well at home, that power, wealth, and opportunity must be in the hands of the many, not the few, if we make that our guiding light for the global economy, then it will be a force for good and an international movement we should take pride in leading.
When they struck, they wanted to create an atmosphere of fear. And one of the great goals of this nation's war is to restore public confidence in the airline industry, is to tell the traveling public, get on board, do your business around the country, fly and enjoy America's great destination
spots. And for some reason, or for bad quality transmission or whatever, the pilot understood that there was a real hijack. And he immediately locked himself, both the pilots locked themselves inside the cockpit, thinking that the hijackers are there in the passenger area.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime
now,
in Afghanistan.
Every Muslim
These
has
carefully
to
targeted
stand
actions
up
are designed
and
to disrupt the use
Islam
of Afghanistan
and
as a terrorist base of
Muslim
operations
brothers in order to
military capability.
Wipe out this act of aggression. With
the State Department ordered all U.S. embassies today to stock up on an antibiotic for treating anthrax. We also learned a little more today about the anthrax which showed up in Florida. So do we know where it came?
This particular battlefront will last as long as it takes to bring Al-Qaeda to justice. It may happen tomorrow. It may happen a month from now. It may take a year or two. But we will prevail. And what the American people need to know is what our allies know. I am determined to stay the course.
President Bush, last night, addressing the nation at his first full-dress press briefing in some weeks, and a bravura performance by most accounts. Jack Beatty, special coverage news analyst, we've been sitting in these chairs and watching this unfold for a month and a day now, and it's been quite a cavalcade of insights and new layers emerging every day. I'm struck in a way at the sense, however fragile, of order that is somehow beginning to emerge around this new conflict, but at the same time, the sense that it could all be shattered with the next attack.
Yeah. I mean, just consider the changes that the month has brought to us. I mean, the airline, the airplane, how the whole association with that has changed. The skyscraper, symbol now of our vulnerability. The letter, the postman, we're now afraid of that. But also, it's changed radically our idea of government. I just dug out the other day a quote from a Newt Gingrich Republican in 1994 saying, the main thing we have to fear is the government. Well, that's gone. And finally, look at the change it's made in our president. You know, he was elected with a shadow of illegitimacy over his election. Many people think, of course, he lost the popular vote. And many people, it was written largely, he thought that he was not up to the job. It was Bush the unready. Was a headline I remember. Mm-hmm. And slowly through this crisis, he has grown under our eyes, I think, and grown in wisdom. The way he is holding off some of the more hawkish elements of his administration right now and trying to keep this focus on bin Laden, on the action in Afghanistan, I think this shows a steadiness and not just resolve, but some pragmatic skill.
You know, there's been so much talk since that time about how it's pulled the nation together, how we're in a changed world, and yet it's so easy to be pulled into cliches. Do you have any sense emerging in your mind yet of the nature of this new path that these events are putting us on, the ways in which it's like and unlike the time before?
I really don't, only that the way the president has set it up, this war as a struggle between freedom and fear, hearkening back to Franklin Roosevelt's Four Freedoms speech of 1940, where the goal of the United States should be to realize the four freedoms. Freedom is a heavier thing than it was. It has a shadow over it, and that's just the reality. And it can be manifested in inconveniences at airports and friction in the economy and distrust of strangers and just simply in a kind of weighted feeling that we're all going to have existentially. And I don't know that that's going to go away. Certainly it's not going to go away, you know, foreseeably. I saw a British analyst refer to this as a long, thin war.
Long and thin. What about there was a... In the immediate aftermath, the sense that we had to figure out why this had happened, and which produced a burst of self-examination, even in the midst of our sorrow. Do you have the sense that that's being sustained? Are we still looking inward as well as outward to figure out what brought us to this pass?
I think that people have sort of struck a balance about that. Yes, our foreign policy has made people around the world unhappy with us. But no amount of their unhappiness can justify what's happened. And yes, the Muslim world in particular has had many grievances with us. But on the other hand, we have helped protect their governments for years. And so I think Americans, yes, we looked inward, but the longer we looked there, I think we discovered, no, we're not culpable here. There's nothing we have done. No sum of what we have done that could have produced this. There was something just wanton and exorbitant about it, and almost, to use a phrase of Shakespeare's, motiveless malignity that struck us. That is to say, there's no motive there other than just this malignity in these people whom the president rightly calls the evil ones.
But what about to Osama bin Laden's main complaints? He says he wants U.S. troops out of Saudi Arabia. He wants I don't know how he would describe it, but he wants justice, in his words, for the Palestinians. Do you see the U.S. any more focused on these articulated goals today than they were a month ago?
Well, I think there's been some change in the Israeli situation. The president spoke to it last night when he said, we are busy on the diplomatic front, meaning we are busy, I would assume, putting some pressure on the Israelis, who God knows, are in a tough position. They're vulnerable to September 11th every day. And it's going to be very difficult for them to take risks for peace. But already I think we see some change there. This week, Chairman Arafat actually put down, and violently, a Hamas-sponsored demonstration, which seemed to signal the world, I want to get aboard. And more importantly, even than that, the Palestinian spokespeople said, no, look, bin Laden, yes, we are oppressed by the Israelis, but that gives you no justification at all for what you did. They've rejected out of hand the bin Laden effort to hijack their cause. This is encouraging, I think.
And yet we know we're still just one or two steps into this, the new reports of anthrax today, and who knows what's going to come.
No, that's it. It's the unfolding and unprecedented nature of this. I mean, our categories are no guide to what's happened.
Jack Beattie, special coverage news analyst, good as always to be with you.
My pleasure.
Another week of incredible developments behind us. For comprehensive coverage of the events of the past month, log on to our website at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.